Greetings, humans. It's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief and all-around gopher for Sensitive Skin Magazine. And we've got a fun one for you today. Today's guest is Vincent Zangrillo. He is the author of the collection of short stories called Dimebag, which was published by Sensitive Skin Books a few years ago. It's the story of his adventures in the East Village and environs back in the 70s to the mid-80s. Our paths never crossed back then, but we were coexisting peacefully in the East Village for a couple of years there in the mid-80s, but we never met. But Vinny's got some great stories about Naropa and meeting Burroughs and Ginsberg there, and especially he spent a lot of time with the great poet and ne'er-do-well Gregory Corso. He tells a very funny story about meeting a Hell's Angel member with Gregory Corso, and how Gregory encouraged him to read his poem in public. He actually ended up living with Gregory for a time in his apartment in the East Village. And Vinny is Vinny. He's got a lot of good stories, and he sure tells them. He tells them good. I should also mention that he wrote the short story The End of the World, which is in the Sensitive Skin Anthology, which you should pick up if you haven't already. You can get it at the usual outlets or order it from your local bookseller. And I should also mention that this one was recorded last summer. I recorded a lot of these last summer when I knew I had the bandwidth and other people had the bandwidth to do this. A lot of writers end up teaching some way or another. I'd say the majority of successful writers, whatever successful means, published writers I know, end up teaching. Because that's just the world we live in these days. So summer was a good time to get a bunch of these done. Anyway, we spoke on August 9th, which Vinny reminded me was the anniversary of Jerry Garcia's death. Turns out we're both deadheads. Yep, I'll let that cat out of the bag. And I was impressed that Vinny actually attended the famous 5777 Dead Show at Cornell, considered by some to be their best show ever, which is kind of a ridiculous label to apply to any band that played over, I don't know, 3,000 shows or whatever, but it's a classic, and I was impressed that he was there. And then we also talked about the other stuff that happened on August 9th. August 9th, the most infamous date in history. You'll hear if you go along, but lots of bad stuff. Some of the worst things that have ever happened in history took place on August 9th. So that's I learned that a long time ago, and I've always been fascinated by it. But I didn't realize that that's the date I took to speak to Vinny. So you can add that to the list of incredibly horrible things that happened on August 9th. My conversation with Vinny Zangrillo. No, I'm just kidding. I kid. It was fun. We had a good time. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Vincent Zangrillo.
Really? Yeah. You could see me?
I can see you. I can hear you.
Fucking
it's
A,
all,
man.
It's all happening.
Okay, let me just ask you one question. Do I look like fucking Colonel Kurtz with this thing around my neck? Because it's fucking schwitzy here, you know what I mean? You live in Northern California, man. You've abandoned the East Coast. You forgot what it's like in the summertime.
I haven't forgotten because I've been back. And
Right. That's when I saw you, right?
Yeah, and I
was that Birdland, fucking the Five Spot, the Fillmore East. No. Shit.
Well, it was the Sidewalk Cafe, which is also as gone past. As any of those other places.
Yeah. Well, you know, like the poet said, the past has never passed. Right? It's somewhere around.
Maybe.
So, maybe. You're done, buddy. What do you want to...
I don't know. How are you doing? Well, so, you know, we could start right off. You intrigued me when we did our test call yesterday. I want to hear the story about Corso and the Hell's Angels.
Oh, Corso and the Hell's Angels. Well, that's got a little bit of a preface to it. I got to kind of work up to that. Is that all right?
Sure.
Yeah, well, see, like, here's the backstory. The backstory was that I was in Albany in 1977, and I was failing Chinese calligraphy. I needed one last class. This is going somewhere. Trust me. So I had to pass one last class to get three more elective credits. So I figured, fucking Chinese calligraphy, right? I mean, who can fail that?
Yeah, how do you fail Chinese calligraphy?
It was a basket weaving course, right? So, but it was at night, and it was fucking Albany, and it snowed in May. Because I remember I was going to see the dead at Cornell in May, and we got caught in a fucking snowstorm. So,
wait a second. Did you see the May 7th, 1977 dead show at Cornell?
I did.
Wow.
I got the t-shirt too in my drawer.
Yeah. Probably didn't seem like anything special at the time, but, you know, in retrospect.
Yeah. Well, you know, the greatest Grateful Dead show is always the one before the first one you saw, and that wasn't the first one I saw, but as is the case with the Grateful Dead. Hey, speaking of the Grateful Dead, today is the 24th anniversary of Jerry's passing.
Oh, that's right.
He was born on the 1st and died on the 9th.
And it's also the 50th anniversary of the Sharon Tate murder, Charles Manson.
It's the 50th anniversary of everything, man.
Yeah.
I didn't know that fucking Manson was dead. I mean, I am not keeping track.
I guess he died a year or two ago.
Bits, you know?
Yeah.
But
interestingly, August 9th is historically a really fucked up day throughout history.
Really?
Yeah. There's it's one of the things it's famous for is that it's the day that the original temple in Jerusalem was first destroyed by the Babylonians.
Really?
And then it was destroyed again by the Romans a few hundred years later, both on August 9th. So
I didn't know. Johnny Carson used to say, I did not know that.
Yeah. Then you got Manson, then you got Jerry, and there's other things too. I mean, it's a historically bad day.
You know, everything. Yeah. But so where was I? Chinese calligraphy. So the teacher comes and it tells me I'm not gonna pass the class, you know. It's like, how can you not pass Chinese calligraphy? But then again, I was the kind of kid that got finger paint all over me in kindergarten, you know. Uh-huh. I couldn't even fucking finger paint. So she sent me for extra help to this woman who lived in an apartment on campus or near campus, and she turned out to be a very hip woman. And I walked in, she had a copy of Gasoline. Of course, there was Gasoline on her coffee table and a catalog for Naropa. And I was like, Naropa, what's that? You know, she told me that she had gone out there the summer before with her biker boyfriend. Boyfriend was the leader of this sort of notorious upstate gang called the White Crosses. Not a white nationalist group. I mean, in those days, yeah. The idea of diversity was like White Crosses, you know, they were sort of like study aides. Like
Wait a minute. White Crosses were speed, right?
Yeah. You know, White Crosses and Black Beauties, that was diversity. So she writes me a letter of introduction to go to stay with somebody, a friend of hers. I get out to Boulder in the summer of 77, and that was, you know, a legendary New York summer, which I wasn't here for. Son of Sam,
oh,
this is burning, you know.
Blackout.
Reggie Jackson and the World Series. And so I made it out there, and I took a few courses, and one of them that I was taking was Gregory Corso's class on poetry. And he was, you know, sort of like a combination of Andrew Dice Clay and Socrates, you know. I think I had registered for one class, but I was sort of like, how can I put it, auditing on a freelance level several other classes, you know.
Just walking in and pretending you belong there.
Just happened to be.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing, and interestingly enough, these classes I discovered a few years back, to my absolute delight and amazement, had been recorded and are on internet archives, that Berkeley-based database.
Cool.
So you could go and you could listen, or anybody can. Anybody in the listening audience can go to internet archives, go to Naropa, and listen to it. I mean, they had great teachers. Ginsberg was unbelievable, erudite, like, you know, the Columbia professor. Gregory was Gregory, you know. Burroughs was Burroughs. But I think... I got
a bone to pick with the Internet Archive, but that's another story.
Okay, yeah, it's another story. At any rate, I think that is where I met, at that first class is where I met Peter Martai, who's right for Sensitive Skin. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning. He introduced me to Mark Fisher, who was a friend of all of ours. He was like a young Rambo Jewish kid from New Jersey who had, he was 17 or something at that time, 18. And so, Course
of Walking. Was that one of the first years? That must have been like right after it started.
No, I think the Rope started in 74, and there's a book called, I won't name
when
it.
When I was cool.
Yeah. Some of my friends don't think that was so cool, but okay. Whatever.
Yeah,
that's, you know.
It was a good read.
It's another issue, yeah. You know, they thought that wasn't willing to get his hands dirty. That was their critique. I mean, Mark Olmsted, who is one of my dear friends, and Peter Marty, friends from those days, Richard Modiano, that, you know, Sam Kashner, you know, he talked the talk, but didn't walk the walk. But at any rate, so Corso, I can remember his opening gambit, you know, he gets in front of the class and he goes, so how many of you fuckers signed up and paid money for this class? So like everybody except for me and maybe one other person raised his or her hand. And he goes, and get the fuck out. I have no respect for anybody that would pay money to hear me speak. So that was like, you know, so that was his thing, you know.
So did people actually leave or?
No. It was Gregory. He was just doing shtick, you know.
Yeah.
He was doing his shtick. And then he goes, so, you know what the cops found when they broke into Ed Gaines' house? And class was like, I don't know. He goes, a cunt in the frying pan.
God.
Shit. So, you know.
I knew people who grew up in the Midwest, and their parents used to, like, scare them with Ed Gaines stories rather than the boogeyman. Or whatever. You know, they said, Ed Gaines is going to come get you if you don't go to bed now.
So he, I remember we read Gilgamesh. That was a big thing for him. He had, like, I have no respect for anyone who'd never read Gilgamesh. You know, fuck you. And, The Third Policeman and a few others. And then, anyway, so, you know, by and by, I got to be friends with Peter, who's written for Sensitive Skin. And Peter took me back to San Francisco and introduced me to Mark Olmsted, who's also a writer for Sensitive Skin. And they introduced me to Richard Modiano, who is also has written for Sensitive Skin. And we've all been close friends since then. You know, I mean, distant friends in the sense of geographical, but close in the sense of, you know, heart and soul.
Sure,
sort of
sure. So,
oh, bikers. The Hell's Angels story. Yeah. Okay, so cut to the last day of Naropa. It's like the last Sunday of Naropa. Trungpa wasn't there, I don't think, but he flew in for this one. He had left Naropa in charge of his regent, Ozel Tenzin, who met an untimely end, but then again, so did Trungpa. At any rate, so there was this big convocation of poets and Buddhists, and for the last send-off, it was like on a Saturday or Sunday, and Gregory was in rare form. I remember he walked in. I mean, the poets were there, the Buddhists were there, and he had a half a bottle of Wild Turkey with him. It was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I assume that it wasn't like left over from last night. You know, it was left over from the morning. So Gregory starts heckling Trungpa, who was like, he was cool about it. I think Trungpa, you know, saw it as a kind of crazy wisdom. As Mark said that Ginsberg said about Gregory, he has the prajna, the wisdom, I think that's the Buddhist word for it, but not the upaya or a skillful means. So he was like, oh, Chogi, you know, who's Death's mother-in-law? Like, you know, I got one for you. Who's Death's mother-in-law? And Trungpa starts laughing. And he goes, yeah, Trungpa. He goes, no, Chogi, I'm really hungry. He goes, why don't you invite me over for dinner? You know, and Chogi's like, and Ginsberg has got his hand over his, you know, eyes, and he's like, oh, God, again, you know? So Gregory goes, if I had a cunt, you'd invite me over for dinner. So, oh God, that was the second time I used cunt in one interview. Okay.
That makes just three. You just said it again.
Shit, that's right.
All right.
You're counting. All right. We could always edit that out later. A vagina in the frying pan, and if you had a vagina...
That cunt is fine.
Over for dinner.
Yeah.
So, So Trungpa had this, like, to me it seemed like the fruit of Islam, you know, these dressed up, they were called the Vajra God. They were dressed in suits and ties, and they were sort of his, a cynical way of looking at it would be his security apparatus, but, you know, who knows. So they escorted Gregory out, right, because this, you know, like I said, Ginsburg was taking it worse than Trungpa, who thought it, I think it was just some form of crazy wisdom. So they escort Gregory out. And so Mark Fisher and I, who, you know, our young friend, our young New Jersey Rambo teenager, and I went out with Gregory, and Mark had a joint. And so he lights up the joint. And I was just standing there to make sure that Mark didn't get too stoned, you know. And he's sharing it with Gregory, you know, and I'm standing there. And this Hell's Angel walks up to us. And he's in full regalia, you know, death's head, everything. And he's like, hey, man, can I get down on that joint? And like, okay, so here's the question. What do you say to a Hell's Angel who asks you if you can get down, if he can get down on that joint? Answer?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So he starts smoking the joint, and Gregory looks up at him, and he goes, so I hear all you Hell's Angels is fags.
Oh,
and I was like, oh, fuck, man. I, like, cover my eyes. Like, you know the moment when you know you're going to get into a crash, you know what I mean, and, like, this, you can't step on the brakes fast enough stop your car from colliding with the one in front of you? So I just sort of closed my eyes for a second. But Gregory had this way of doing it so that when I opened my eyes, the Hell's Angel was laughing. You know, it was, like, so audacious. And so the Hell's Angel goes, okay, yeah, I know Allen Ginsberg. I met him at Sonny Barge's house in 1965 in Oakland. And I was, because there was that famous peace summit between Ginsberg and Sonny Barger when the Hell's Angels were harassing the anti-war demonstrators. So Gregory goes, great, great, great. And so the angel goes, and I'm a poet too. And Gregory goes, really? A poet, you know? Let's hear your shot. And so he goes, no, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Let's hear it, you know? So the angel says, okay, well, I wrote this one in San Quentin. When I was in the B ward, that's where they put the bad boys. And so he recites the poem, which was word for word, Shazeen Shazam, get fucked, goddamn, rotten meat, stinking ham, yay, Hell's Angels. So Gregory looks at him and goes, that's fucking brilliant. Uh-huh. You know, that's a great shot. You know, that's so fucking good. You got to read that. You know, he goes, I'm, you know, I know Alan. Let's come on. And the angel's like, no, I don't want to go. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. So after getting thrown out by the Vajra God, Gregory drags this angel back in and pushes him up on stage with Trungpa and Ginsberg and says, Alan, you got to hear this, man. This is great. This is the fucking pure poetry, you know, the pure poetry shot. So the guy, you know, he gets up to the microphone and clears his throat, and he's like, and gives the same introduction. I wrote this in San Quentin, you know, in the B ward. And he goes, once again, Shazeen Shazam, get fucked, goddamn, rotten meat, stinking ham, yay, Hell's Angels. And then by then, Gregory had worked his way to the back of the audience. And all you heard from the back was this, you know, Gregory's cackling, I'm so embarrassed. You know? And Gregory split, of course, and left everybody else, the Hell's Angel, Ginsberg, Trungpa, and everybody else on stage holding the bag, you know. So that was the classic. That, I don't think that one's ever been told or written.
That's
down.
Pretty good. And how long did you stay at Naropa?
Just for the summer. Then I went out to San Francisco where I met and became very good friends with Olmsted, who became my film guru, showing me films like that either I had seen but I had not really paid attention to, like Dirty Harry and performance. And, you know, Mark can do both a Mick Jagger and a Mick Jagger imitation and a Clint Eastwood. You know, he can go from, well, you know, the only performance, the only one that really makes it is the one that achieves total madness. You know, are you right? Are you with me? To, I know what you're thinking. But this is the 357 Magnum. So yeah. Mark was great. And he, Peter and Mark introduced me to some of their friends. And they were not into the Dead. They were into the punk rock scene, Mojave Gardens. But whatever. So I was there for a couple of months, and then I came back, and you know, one thing led to another. But Mark Fisher and I eventually got an apartment. You know, in the days we can get apartments on in the East Village for a couple hundred bucks a month, and we lived on First Avenue and 11th Street, which was around the corner from the Poets' House, Ginsberg's building,
right,
on 12th and A, which was like the Poets' building. And so Gregory and his wife, at the time, Lisa, and his son, Max, who was 4 years old, were staying at Ginsey's, and it was, you know, I'm sure it was tight quarters. And Orlovsky's girlfriend, whose name was, I think her name was Rosebud, I'm not sure, and some other guy named Patrick were in this punk rock band called the Stimulators. And they were practicing in Ginsey's apartment, and they were really, really loud. And from what I heard, Gregory tried to outblast them with Mahler's Fifth Symphony, but he was unable to drown them out. So eventually he ended up cutting their amp cords. And so Ginsberg had to throw him out. And then he moved in with us, his, you know, with his wife and his kid and me and Mark in this railroad flat on First Avenue above, you know, like a, like really close to DiRoberto's pastry shop in Vignero. So,
So yeah, you've written a bunch of stories about that era that we've published in Sensitive Skin.
Yes. Well, those stories are part of, they were engendered by Richard Modiano, who a couple of years ago sent me a text or an email, and he said, you got to check this out. See what, is being sold on eBay. And when I looked, there were three postcards from Gregory Corso and his very good close friend, who is even now editing a book of Corso's not new poetry, but poetry that he wrote towards the end of his life. And apparently it's brilliant, but it's being published by New Directions. So George Cavani, who was a good friend of Gregory's, a very, very, very close friend. Gregory loved George, and they sent three postcards from Europe to Mark and I, and then, you know, 25 years later, I found them on eBay, and I ended up paying like $100 for them, and so it touched off a sort of Proustian memory chain for me. Mm-hmm. So I have about 34 pieces. A few of them are in Sensitive Skin, but they all are sort of like jazz-like in the sense that they have a like an opening, an intro with a head and some choruses that are variations that reflect off the, you know, the head of the piece, and then a sort of outro which brings back the, you know, the initial the variation on the initial. The initial like head of the piece, the initial melody, or the changes over the melody. Uh-huh. So I, you know, it's not Mexico City Blues, but you know, it's something, and the story is all sort of interconnected in some way, shape, or form. So that's what I did. I'm working on a pretty cool thing, tentatively entitled "Let Me Take You Down," and it's a crime novel set in New York between the late 70s and the mid 90s, and it ties together three iconic New York crimes: the Lufthansa heist, the murder of John Lennon, and the Robert Chambers. You know Robert? Remember Robert Chambers?
Yeah.
Killer.
Yeah, he killed the. He strangled Jennifer the girl Lavin. In Central Park, and then he went off and was skiing in Switzerland for 10 years before he finally gave himself
they
up.
They caught up with him and put him in jail. He was going to a very exclusive Catholic prep school, and It was the guy was a disaster, but it was.
But didn't New York. He got caught and then like he was out on bail and I think he absconded to Europe and stayed there for like 10 years before he finally gave himself
up. Chambers didn't have the wherewithal to do that. He got caught. The attorneys proffered this rough sex defense that he claimed that that she had. Had rough sex with him, and he was trying to get her off of him. They were in Fulgente Delectio in Central Park at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And
I'm looking it up right now. I want to know.
What's that?
I'm looking it up right now. I want.
Oh yeah. So he and the cops said, "Listen,
nicknamed the Preppy Killer."
What's the name?
He was nicknamed the Preppy Killer.
The Preppy Killer, right? Exactly, and he he ended up, the defense was unsuccessful, but he copped a plea. I think the jury was hung. He copped a plea to involuntary manslaughter and got like 5 to 15. But he kept getting slapped with summonses. Come here, Koshek. Hold on a second. Now I know why Stella Adler had Brando always pick up something in his scenes. So, he ended up, he got hit with so many charges for drug possession and fighting with corrections officers that he did the full time. And then after he got out, he went back to coke and dope dealing in New York. And he's still in jail now. He's still alive.
Mm. So wait, let's go back a minute though. You wrote a lot of those stories and Corso is one of the figures that always presents himself, but you also mention some of the John Waters crew, like Cookie Mueller and people like that. How did you get to know those guys?
First of all, downtown New York was, and I'm not trying to make myself out as any sort of like pioneer. It was just starting to get repopulated. And obviously, the East Village back in the '60s and the Open Eye Bookstore and the Fugs and, Ed Sanders and the Fillmore and all that shit. But I moved from the East Village to the West Village on Leroy Street. I lived with Richard Modiano, and Gregory introduced me to Cookie. Gregory was, as his friend Roger Richards said, at his funeral memorial, it wasn't like, you were wearing a hair suit, he was all suffering with Gregory,
Yeah.
I, of course, was trying to help him with his drug problems.
Yeah. I always thought he was far and away the best beat poet.
Oh, well, so did Ginsberg, you know?
Yeah.
I'll say this, I'm not in any, poetry is not actually my forte, and I'm not in any position to rank them. But Alan thought he was. And I think everyone understands him as being a natural genius, autodidactic.
And he's also kind of like, a holy fool kind of guy, right? I mean,
yeah. He was unschooled, but autodidactic. He knew a lot. And he had a natural, like some people have to go to Juilliard. Some people pick it up,
Right. But didn't he grow up in like reform schools and stuff? Or
The stories about Gregory are legend, and you never knew what was true and what was, what was fact and what was fiction.
Right.
But that part was true. There's a film that I would recommend called The Last Beat, because at the end of his life, he had, he outlived Alan, and he had, prostate cancer, and he was living with Roger Richards, who was a bookseller in New York. He had a bookstore in the West Village for first editions, and Roger was also an addict, and Gregory was, but he managed to get a couple of wealthy patrons at the end, and it was the Last Beat tells a story about how he, who thought his mother had died and went to look for her grave in Italy and believed his whole life up until, maybe a year before his death, that his mother had died he actually found out, I think his mother was a teenager when she had him, that she had been living in New Jersey all this time with his sister. And he never got along with his father, so he did spend a lot of time in reform schools and then pulled a caper and ended up in, not Dannemora, Clinton, I think. One of those upstate hellholes. But he was supposedly the youngest one there, and that's part of the mythos of Gregory. Now, that movie explains a lot. There's also George Scovani, the person I mentioned earlier, and Raymond Foy, who has the weird, not weird, but totally cool coincidence of being a beat scholar and an editor. He wrote a book on Bob Kaufman, or edited a book on Bob Kaufman, and he was the one that started Hanuman Press, you know, those little, so he was also a very good friend of Gregory's. He was Jack Kerouac's paper boy in Lowell. So that was like a one time, you know. At any rate, so they just recently put out a recording of Gregory, because George Cavalli did for Gregory what, what's his name, Nick Benedetti did for Charlie Parker. He just set up a tape recorder whenever he was reading in Europe or something and taped it. So, yeah, a lot of it is, it's hard to separate the fact from the fiction. And Gregory,
when did Corso die? Not that long after Ginsberg, if I.
Not terribly long, but he outlived Allen by a number of years.
Okay,
because he was sort of more of a recluse during that time, because there was a wealthy Japanese benefactor who actually rented him an apartment right next door to Roger Richards, who was just one of these downtown figures.
Did you know Hunky as well?
Who?
Herbert. Did you know Herbert Hunky?
Did I know Herbert Hunky?
Yeah.
In the sense that, yeah, we would go to B&H and have, you know, like, I didn't, yeah. What?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I've got another interesting factoid you talked about. You know who Hunky's benefactor was?
Yeah, I read that too.
Jerry Garcia paid his rent at the Chelsea Hotel. Yeah.
Yeah, and he never
actually met him or talked.
Never
to him
actually met him, you know. And I have another story on semi-reliable good sources, which are all my sources are semi-reliable. This cat I know who was in rehab with Jerry and at the time of his death in 1995, on this day in 1995, and he claims that John Kahn, the bass player and Jerry's drug buddy from the Jerry Garcia band.
Sure.
Came to the rehab and snuck Jerry out, and they had a parking lot party. And, you know, this is sort of like that movie about Grand Parsons, you know, Grand Theft Parsons, like that Jerry actually died in John Kahn's car in the parking lot, that he OD'd or had a heart attack or whatever for cocaine. And then Kahn smuggled him back into the rehab place.
And now, Kahn died. Like 6 months later, too, of an OD.
Yeah. Anybody that was in Gregory's orbit, another charismatic figure, Garcia's orbit, you know, that tried to follow in his footsteps, like Brent Midland and Vince Welnick, they all ended up dying. Okay, Kitty.
But anyway, okay. I was going to say it's funny, but like the beats, I remember you saying Gregory lasted a few more. I kind of remember it just seemed to that Burroughs, Ginsberg, Corso, Hunky, all died within a very short time period, kind of like the Ramones, you know?
Like right. Well, they were, Gregory was the youngest, and I guess Hunky was probably the oldest, but, you know, for all the, the abuse, and certainly I'm not advocating of that, but, you know, it was just amazing. Burroughs lived to, I think Allen took the best care of himself.
Yeah, and Burroughs lived to his 80s.
Yeah, and so did Hunky. You know, he was living down Avenue C at some point.
Burroughs had people taking care of him. Hunky did not, you know, and he still managed
I think Allen set everybody up a little bit, you know, with his foundation, towards the end of his life, because, you know, how compassionate he was. So I think Hunky had people going to get medicine for him, you know, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And,
I did a reading with him in like 92 or something like that.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Cool. What's that like?
With Hunky. He was great. You know?
But, yeah. Hunky had no ego. I mean, he was like a totally humble cat, you know, like he was just glad if he saw you and you started talking to him.
It was actually a benefit. It was actually a sensitive skin benefit.
Oh, cool.
The original version of Sensitive Skin, and we were trying to raise money to print the issue, and there were a few of us who read, and John
Ferris. Was it in New York?
Yeah, in New York. We did it at the Living Theater and on 3rd Street. Yeah, 3rd Street between C and D, and John Ferris was doing the door. And
I'm sorry, who was doing the
John
door?
Ferris, the poet John Ferris. I don't know if you know him. Different overlapping circles, but that was he was kind of like my literary mentor. He passed away a few years ago, but and John was doing the door, and then, you know, afterwards, Hunky came up and said, "I want $200." And I was like, "What? This is a benefit." You know? And he's like, "If you had William Burroughs here, you'd give him $200."
Right.
And
right.
I said,
So I said,
like, sorry, you're not William Burroughs. Anyway, I gave him $20 and he went off to like shoot coke with his, 19-year-old pair of boys that he was hanging out with. You know?
Yeah. No, I believe that. I mean, I did. I don't know if we talked about it, but, I had heard that Burroughs was going to go on the Rolling Thunder tour with Ginsberg, but he asked for like $1,000, and Dylan said no.
Oh, really?
I'm not paying.
Really?
Not paying you, but that's Dylan. So,
how did you meet the Waters crew?
Oh, the Waters crew, right. Well, Gregory was really good friends with Cookie Mueller, who was... she was part of the Waters crew, you know, she was help me.
Right. She was in all the early movies.
All the early ones.
Yeah. And then she was like a New York, and I also knew she was like a downtown superstar kind of person. She had a column in the local paper and all that stuff. And,
yeah. She had this,
was
she
it called? Ask Dr. Mueller.
Cookie was one of these people who was like a downtown diva, you know, she was an actress.
Right.
She was close with Waters. She was from Baltimore. She was close with Waters and all those people. Had acted in, what was the first famous one with
Pink
the
Flamingos
chicken?
And
Pink Flamingos and other movies being made downtown by the downtown, as I dubbed them, the Downtown Artists and Writers Drug Guild. And she had a column in High Times called Ask Dr. Cookie, which was pretty funny. Right. And she was,
I think it was also, they also reprinted in The Voice or something. I remember.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And she had a Hanuman book. There's been a sort of like a resurgence. A woman wrote a book about Cookie. And since then there's been a resurgence. She was bisexual and her girlfriend was named Sharon. And, apparently the story that I heard, I mean, this is what she told me, that they were in like Positano one time, and Gregory, they were coming in like on a, Gregory might have like known who they were. They were coming in like on a launch into Positano, and Gregory had a white suit on and was like halfway up, you know, to his waist in the water with a bottle of that. What's that orange Italian soda called?
Orangina?
Yeah. And it was filled with vodka, half filled with vodka. So he went back to their hotel room and jumped into bed with Cookie and Sharon. And, like, you know, he could get away with it. And so later when he introduced me to them, and I said, oh, Sharon, you know, I like her, you know, she's attractive. You know? He goes, yeah, you could definitely get her, you know. I was like, really, you think so? And he's like, yeah, yeah. You know? I didn't have the, I was naive. I was a naive kid, and I didn't know. So I made a sort of a play for Sharon, but it was Cookie that I ended up having a, you know, more intimate friendship with.
Interesting. All right.
Sharon was only into women.
And then after your East Village adventures were over, when did you leave the East Village? Because I think we kind of just missed each other. I arrived in 84.
Yeah, no, we overlapped. We overlapped because I didn't leave until... And 84 was like when things... I think things were peaking in a certain sort of sense. I left in 87, like the summer of 87, I believe. So we were probably there for 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, okay. The scene was expanding.
It's kind of funny. It's like what you said earlier about like the best Dead show was the one right before you saw them.
Yeah.
And that's what I remember. I moved into the East Village in 84 and heard from like, oh yeah, this place was great a year ago. And I heard that for the next like 15 years or something like that.
Right. You know? Right. And so, right. That's always the case. And you know, I always feel that way. Like, yeah, you know, I missed out on this or I missed out on that, you know, cause I had a sense that I was more like lost in the past. So I wasn't so much an active member of the Downtown Artists and Writers Drug Guild as I was an observer, because I never felt completely comfortable. You know, I first of all, I had no pretensions at that time, although I do now, of being a writer, or an artist.
So when did you start writing?
Well, I started scribbling around that time, but I wasn't in any kind of real organized way, and it was sort of notes that became the book that Sensitive Skin published.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dimebag.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But that was sort of done. The notes were taken at the time, but the book was written slightly afterwards, and you know, in the late 80s. They were there in a rough form from 78 to 86, but then I went back maybe in the, I had various drafts of it, you know, until it got published. Uh-huh. So
where'd you go after you left the East Village?
I moved to Long Beach, which was Long Beach is sort of like the Asbury Park of Long Island. You know, at that time it was the place. It's maybe a half an hour from Queens, from the Rockaways, and it was a place that had apartment buildings and mental patients on the boardwalk in various nursing homes or psychiatric facilities, and old Jewish people. It had been sort of like a smuggler's haven during the Prohibition. And it was grungy, and now, like everything else, it got nicer. So I stayed there, and I started teaching in Queens, in South Jamaica, during the crack epidemic in the, you know, about 87, 86, 87.
So you were an English teacher?
Yes.
Okay. And you recently retired.
I did. I retired so that I could devote myself more full time to writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see how that goes. You know, I mean,
how's it going? Are you playing golf or going to casinos, or are you actually watching Law and Order reruns on TV all afternoon?
No. Lately I've been binge watching the Wire, which I didn't see when it was on because there were too many kids that I knew at the school that I was working at who were emulating, you know, that whole thing. And I found it like kind of like being it wasn't like being at work, but it reminded me of it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and doing some reading. This book, The Good Blonde, is one that Mark recommended to me. It was like Outtakes of Kerouac, which is really quite good. And a former student of mine, who lives in Paris, as a film critic, and I went to Metrograph, which is a very cool place. Now they have downtown, where they have it's more like, I guess you'd find it in Europe. They have food and drinks and a library, and they show 35mm prints. He wrote a book on Darius Kunji, the cinematographer, And there's interviews with various directors that he worked with, including James Gray and Woody Allen, all sorts of people.
And I see
he did cinematography for Seven, that horrific.
And I see you've got James Ellroy's Perfida. Is that the new one?
Yeah, that came from the West Coast Boys, from either Peter Marty. And speaking of Peter Marty, who's in Europe somewhere, I can't find a fucking first edition of On the Road, and it's probably worth like $5,000. I got it in a barter for something or another,
really?
You know, back then. And
it's probably worth more than that now.
Yeah, probably. But I'm not blaming Peter. I'm just saying he's the only person that's been in my house that would actually know how much it was worth.
Oh, it's gone missing, you mean?
Yeah. Well, the most likely scenario is that I overstashed it, as we used to call it. Like I went away, and I shouldn't have, because no idiot that would break into a fucking house would know enough, you know, to steal a copy of On the Road. So I probably just hit it so well.
Yeah.
Left.
Yeah. My books disappear all the time. I'm always looking, you know, for where the heck did my copy of whatever go? And, you know,
yeah,
some of the stuff is there. And I was like, yeah, just, I don't know, various moves, stuff just, so the books are like, you know, socks in the dryer, I think. They just kind of disappear sometimes.
Yeah. I think I probably dug a hole and buried it somewhere.
Yeah. But funny, a friend of mine just bought a copy of, first edition, I think, of Blood Meridian.
Yeah.
On the street in New York, for $9. The guy wanted 10.
Yeah.
The guy wanted 10, and he said, "I only got 9 on me, but it's worth like 5 or 10 grand or something like that." Because it sold like 500 copies or something like that. The original.
He's a favorite of those guys, and but yeah, like back in the day, there used to be a million used bookstores, and what you used to be able to do was go to a used bookstore, find something that was, before everything was, you know, the price of everything was known on the computer, you could find something that they were selling for $10, and you knew if you brought it to a first edition shop like Robert Wilson's on Jones Street or Roger Richards, or if you brought it to the Rare Book Room at the Strand, you could sell it for $20. So, you know.
Right. But it's funny. So now everybody knows, right, because of like eBay or whatever, you just like say, "Hey, I got one of these. I wonder what it's worth," and you can find out pretty quick.
Right,
but
right.
I thought
right.
This just happened like a month ago. The guy's a guy selling books on the street, and he didn't know how much his first edition of Blood Meridian was worth. So
right.
it can still happen, I guess.
Yeah, one of my, you know, it's, you know, you buy for a nickel and you sell for a dime, you know, capitalism, but. So you could make enough money to live, actually, you know, because prices were pretty low. A friend of mine, actually, in those days, a filmmaker that Richard Modiano knows well, his name will remain, I think, I haven't seen him in quite a while, so I'll keep his name out of it. But he, he actually lived. His mother was a very close friend of Jackson Pollock's and lived, and his father, and she was an artist, and his father was a photographer, a Swiss photographer, and they lived next door to Pollock in the Springs. And a couple of years ago, this guy, I read about in the paper, I didn't see him. I haven't seen him or talked to him in years. He found, you know, in his like father's storage space, like all these Jackson Pollock paintings.
Wow.
Well, you know, they were sort of... They were never verified, you know.
Yeah, I love stories like that. You know, there's always.
Oh yeah,
there's something in Paris. I mean, a few years ago, where this 94-year-old lady died, and her kids went up in her attic, and there was like I forget what it was, a Monet or a Cezanne that she'd had stashed there for 80 years or something like that, or.
One of the stories that is most circulated about me, I mean, there are stories, most of them are fictional, but this one actually happened. I threw a Basquiat painting out of my window in a fit of peevishness. I threw a Basquiat painting out of my window into the ash shaft of the alley that I was living in. I was living in the alley. I misplaced my modifiers there somewhere. I was living in the apartment. the ash shaft went into the alley. Basquiat was, I'll make it a short story. He was in love with someone that I sort of loved. So I had a kind of I was predisposed to have a negative attitude towards it. But Mark Fisher, the young Ribot, was, he was also in love with this, well, in a certain sense, this woman who was a beautiful artist and remains a friend until this day. And Basquiat got kicked out of her. He was crashing at her place. And one day, do you remember the bar Grassroots?
Yeah, Grassroots Tavern.
Yeah, it was like,
St. Mark's Place.
Right in the middle of St. Mark's Place. At that time, it was like the only bar. You can imagine, like, it was like the only bar for, like, people like us to hang out. And then the St. Mark's Bar and Grill opened up. It was like a dive bar. I mean, people used to go to dive bars, but, you know, like the ones on 7th Street, those Ukrainian bars. But so this woman walks into Grassroots, and Mark and I are there having a beer, and she's distraught, and she goes, Jean-Michel, he was completely terrifying and fucked up. And while I was gone, he cut up all my clothes with a pair of scissors, and he broke all my cups and plates. And I was like, oh God, you know? And Mark said, that's brilliant. You know, now you can't go out and you can't invite anybody over. So to get him out of this woman's hair, he said to him, you know, you can crash at our place. So, fuck, you know, we lived in a railroad apartment on First Avenue. So, you know how those apartments were. You walked into the kitchen. It was like the sixth floor up. You walked into the kitchen. You had to walk through the little parlor.
Right.
And then you walked through one bedroom. You had to walk through that bedroom to get to the bedroom at the end.
You have a bathtub in the kitchen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the tub in the kitchen thing. So I had the apartment that was on the street, on the avenue. So I had to walk through Mark's room, and I would get home, and I would be feeling a little bit, like peevish, and Jean-Michel would be passed out on the floor and crash. I had to step over the fucker, and like I said, I was predisposed not to like him anyway. And with my great taste in art, I thought that he would never get famous, you know, and was an actual fraud. And so, you know, one time, just to show my displeasure, I took some of his paintings that he had there, and I ripped them up and threw them out the ash shaft, which, if I would have kept them, would probably, I'd be living
in a mansion in Southampton.
One in Southampton, one in Mill Valley.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
So, but as I said in one of my stories, the only good thing about regrets is that you have to be alive to. You have to be alive to have him.
Yeah.
You know, my friends.
It's funny. I never met him, but I knew a million people who knew him, and not one of them managed to hang on to one of his paintings.
Right.
Because, you know, when he was selling his paintings for $500, and who had $500 to buy a painting back then?
Right. So what's the future of Sensitive Skin? Let's talk about your shit. I mean, your good shit.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. We're coming out with by the time this airs, maybe the books will be out already. Coming out with a translation of Yesenin poems by the poet Anton Yakovlev. Yesenin is I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He's the most beloved Russian poet of the 20th century. Big rival of Mayakovsky, but Yesenin is still just like every Russian person you'd ever meet knows at least one of his poems by heart. He's just, you know, and strangely enough, he's barely if ever been translated into English. Just an odd poem here or there. So that's a big coup, and we're coming out with a. Anthology of writing, stories, poetry, and essays from the last few years since we stopped doing print issues. And you're going to be in there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I put The End of the World, that one, in there.
Oh, yeah. Well, The End of the World is the end of that cycle of stories. And it's the first one where I I changed points of view in the story from it starts off in a third person, it goes to second person, and then ends up in first person.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got all the usual suspects.
Yeah.
In it. Yeah. 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 That, well, thank you. I mean, yeah.
It's a great story.
I'm honored to be.
And then yeah. I have to embarrassingly say the third book is by me. I'm putting out a novel that I wrote, which is kind of fun. It's a mystery noir comedy satire
that
takes place in Marin County. So it's really just the whole plot is basically just an excuse to make social commentary and tell stories. But
yeah, I did that. I did a novel which I never got published about the Hamptons from the point of view of pool cleaners who are also selling cocaine to rich people from the city on the side when they clean their pools. So that April Pool Company, that maybe will see the light of day sometime. And another one about a guy named Gus, I can't forget his last name. This is another notorious New York story. This guy back in the 80s, might be right before you got there, maybe right after, he killed in a botched drug deal. He killed an undercover DEA agent and was he was pursued by both the FBI and the DEA, and eventually they got the five families in on it because they shut down business in New York until they coughed him up. And it's an interesting story. But in the story, you know, it's fictionalized because this never happened. He basically never left New York. But in the story, the character based on him, it's not actually him, falls in with the Downtown Artists and Writers Drug Guild, who, you know, he adopt him, you know, as this kind of like Joey Gallo figure, you know, like someone that could make, you know, like to have someone like that around, you know, like a real character. So that also might perhaps see the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the one thing. Let me just give you the coda to the Gregory Corso story to be recursive and go around to it again. In the end, when he was dying, he was living on Horatio Street and 8th Avenue, like a stone's throw from that pub that he really liked, the Village Bistro. And he had a Japanese benefactor. He had this movie made about him. So, yeah, so he's dying of prostate cancer. And somehow, as karma would have it, a woman named Sherry, who was his daughter that he never knew about, because he had a number of children, Max, Miranda, they were from different women. She shows up at his apartment. She finally finds out who her father is. She's middle-aged. She's 40. Gregory's 65, 67, something like that. She shows up at his apartment on Horatio Street, finds him, right? He's in a hospital bed in the apartment, and it turns out, and this is some good karma. It turns out she was an oncology nurse from Minnesota, you know, and so she took care of him.
Wow.
You know, and at the same time, and this is in the last beat, the same time he goes to, this is great, he goes to Italy to find the grave of his mother. Because the Italians, you know, you could find baptism certificates, you know, like, or you could find death certificates where someone's buried, you know, by the parish. So he goes with somebody who helps him look, and they go to the town where she was born and where he thinks she moved to. They can find no record of her death. So Gregory cuts out, and he was sick at this time, right? He suffering from prostate cancer. He did this sort of like whirlwind tour of all his favorite places in Europe, you know, to go to Greece and Paris and Firenze and all that. And so he comes back to New York to watch the World Series on TV. I don't remember what year it was. And this guy calls up and says, look, you know, I got some news for you. And Gregory's like, you know, I could wait till the end of the inning. So the guy says, okay, you know. So Gregory calls him back. And the guy says, guess what? Not only is your mother alive, she's living in New Jersey right now, you know. And he tracked her down to New Jersey. And in the film, you see a very ill, you know, Gregory Corso going to see his mother, who looks, you know, much healthier than he does. Mm. And she's, you know, like the Italian mother, you know, she hasn't seen her kid in 50 years. And she says, you know, Gregory, why don't you cut your hair? But that's how the story ends, you know. And then Sherry took him out to Minnesota at the very end to, like, home, you know, like hospice care. Yeah. At her home. So, yeah. And there was also one amazing thing that I remember. I don't know who told me this, but that he went to, at the end of Alan's life, Alan was living on 14th Street. He started using some of the money that he had. He, you know, instead of a 6-floor walk up, because he had various health problems, he got an elevated building on 14th Street. And Gregory came to visit him when he was on his deathbed. He had his Tibetan Lama there that he studied with. And somebody, Gregory was like leaning over, and somebody was said something to Gregory, and Gregory said, "Shh, Alan is teaching me how to die." Mm. And I thought that was a very poignant thing. And you know, Gregory was a complex person, you know, and yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I have good news and bad news.
We're over.
Yeah. The bad news is, I have to say, I'm sorry, we're out of time.
And that's okay.
The good news is I'm not going to send you a bill for $300 like most people do when they say that.
Okay. All right.
All right,
good
man.
Good talking to you, buddy. And
yeah,
and I'll catch up with you on the West Coast, maybe.
Yeah, come on out. Or, you know, I'll be out on the East Coast sooner rather than later, probably, maybe this fall. So
okay.
All right. I'll talk to you, man.
Okay. Ciao, okay. Man. Be well.
Bye.